Hello, hello, hello. This is Richard Bennett on the High Tech Forum podcast. Today, our guest is Neil Davies, one of, I think, the world's leading network quality engineers, who's just completed a report for Ofcom, the FCC of the United Kingdom, on network quality of experience, Delta Q, and some topics that we'll get into as the conversation progresses. So, hello, Neil.
Hello, Richard.
For folks, since you're an extremely well-known name in international network engineering circles, but our audience is many of our audience, I think, are DC policymakers, so they're probably not as familiar with the players in this space as some of us are. So why don't you help the listeners understand your background a little bit by talking about how you what sort of work you do and how you came to be interested in quality of service and quality of experience on networks. Why would Ofcom turn to you for an analysis?
Okay, right. So it all goes back actually to my, back to my first job after graduating, working in networks and protocols at the time when, IP was just a twinkle in people's eyes still. And the UK was engaging in its own activities in this area. And so I got, I picked up things like copies of the X25 colored books from the late 70s. And there was a wonderful section which said quality of service and the three fateful words for future study. right. And I basically then said, well, look, this can't be difficult. And so I, sat down and thought about it for a couple of hours and then a couple of weeks. And then I realized that there was some really tough stuff inside this. And so I set it on the back burner while I worked in the areas of distributed computing, large scale supercomputers, and networking.
So this would have been what, the early 80s, mid 80s?
This is the mid 80s, early 90s, working on complex systems, not just about where networks were an integral part of the solution, right? Data delivery was, right? So we're talking, I don't know if words like the transputer and So, I was working with people building 1,000 node computers back in the early 90s, okay? And what became very clear was that we lacked a few couple of basic pieces of understanding in how we as people reasoned about networks. And one of them was we couldn't see how they were going to perform before we built them. And the second was everything was basically assuming that the network never became saturated.
Which is it's not an unreasonable assumption if you're working with a circuit switch network, like the public switch telephone network. But
yes, true. But it is a problem inside, say, a complex supercomputer, whereas actually there's always something that is your bottleneck.
Well, and saturation from one point of view is simply full utilization from another point of view. So
absolutely, right.
You build and a network to be used.
You build a network to be used, and you build a supercomputer to solve a problem or to have a whole series of problems, and you want to get those solutions out as fast as possible. Mm-hmm. And basically what you want is you don't want it to fall over its feet. You wanted a predictable region of operation, mm-hmm. which didn't have a nasty turning point that meant that the more you drove it, the worse the performance became, right?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, so at the same time, I was at the University of Bristol, computer science department there, and I was also involved in areas like safety systems research center going on there. So we'd have meetings with people who were trying to use network technology for things like distributed air traffic control, for example, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or looking at it. And what became very clear was that people couldn't make the safety case for large, complex, distributed systems, and you couldn't reason about them. So I managed to get some money out of them, actually, and got a few PhD students and took the issue of not just how things perform, but how systems evolve, given that they are embedded inside a system with a certain performance, and reason about the evolution of complex systems from both a performance and a safety perspective at the same time.
So this kind of analysis is not strictly limited to the network, but it's a comprehensive view of how the application performs in a distributed system where you have multiple CPUs who are all bound together by networking. Is that fair to say?
That's fair to say. I mean, it's not just about it is about, it's about both the application and the set of applications at the same time. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so, you know, things went on, and I left the university for a startup, and which we, you know, co-founded with a few people. And later on, I ended up in the early 2000s, working where this all sort of started to come together, with respect to a very large program in the United States called Future Combat Systems, which was a $300 billion. Project that was its starting price tag. Mm-hmm. For basically the U.S. Army field forces, the ability to construct the bit that was particularly interesting that we got involved with was the ability to construct a distributed computer system, work out all the design rules, deploy it 48 hours in a get 48 hours notice to deploy, deploy it and run it for a week to have a combat engagement, even under the presence of hostile interactions against it. Okay,
These are like the battlefield systems that are they're predominantly wireless mesh networks. Is that correct?
Yes. So basically, we had to look at the emergent performance problems or issues of complex wireless mesh networks when they were under attack, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's so basically when the capacity was massively reduced, and how could you reason about what was safe?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Right. So this again, so what's interesting, the theme that we came about this problem was not to think about necessarily constructing just success modes, i.e. the application works, but to do some real engineering, because real engineers take responsibility for their failure modes too.
Right.
Right. And to look at how the system could be reasoned about and how it would fail under stress.
So the when you talk about reasoning about the networks, you're talking about what it is that you want to assess, what you want to measure, how you determine quality, right?
How you determine success, yes, right? Because you have this idea of, and success in this environment is delivering information to the places that need it in the timescales they need it.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah, because it's in the nature of networks that at any instant, at any moment in time, it's possible that the load that is offered to the network by the total collection of users can exceed the capacity of the network at certain points, at least.
Yep. It's and I mean that is the very reason why we have always on global connectivity, because it's that property mm-hmm. that permits us to construct economic networks.
Yeah, in the telephone network days, I mean we really did notice moments of overcapacity in the U.S. typically on Mother's Day,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes on Christmas Day. But the network protected itself from overload by simply not connecting calls when it didn't have the capacity to put the call through at the predictable guaranteed quality. But there was a downside to that, and that was that the quality of a telephone call, while it never fell below a certain floor, never went above the ceiling either. And so mm-hmm. when we wanted to use those telephone connections to connect modems and to download files, well, we found that there were certainly instances in which we wanted more capacity than a telephone call required, and the system simply wasn't capable of giving it to us because of its basic overall design. So we went to always-on broadband packet switch statistical systems.
Yes, and in doing so, right, the game changed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is the. You know, this is probably the crux of the point, is that at that point, you had a system previously which was statistically multiplexed, but it basically multiplexed your admission to the system, mm-hmm. and it had was designed and ranked in such a way that, you know, 1 in 200, 1 in 500 calls would fail at the, in the busy hour, fail mm-hmm. to get connected. Yeah, it was designed that way. It was a system that also, you know, through the, you know, GETs and other systems similar, could actually degrade gracefully if it had to in an emergency, right? By not admitting whole classes of user to make call. Mm-hmm. When you went to the statistically multiplexed world, you admit the information without the knowledge of knowing that you can actually get it there in the timescales.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. It's ballistic, right, in that sense. And it turns out that actually you can't know in advance, because if you were to try and build control loops over these systems, you find that you can't get the information back fast enough to control the system, mm-hmm. because it can only travel as fast as the data in the network. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so there is an issue here that, you know, what we have in our large scale packet switch networks is systems in which, you know, both the control traffic and the protocol traffic are flowing in the same systems. I mean, what another way of looking at this is to say what the networks do, right? And what networks do is they construct both connectivity and performance. Mm-hmm. And those two things are interlinked.
Right.
And without the, you can't have connectivity without performance. You can't have performance without connectivity. And that's the issue that the statistically multiplex systems have, is that if you let the performance drop too low for certain things, the integrity of the connectivity fails, for example. Mm-hmm.
Well, we're dealing with a scenario where in the telephone network, there were limited interactions between users. So mm-hmm. the only effect really that users had on each other was whether you could get your call connected. But once your call was connected, there was virtually no interaction between users. In a statistically multiplex system, the interaction between users is continuous.
Yes. So what we have here is there's no performance isolation. Mm-hmm. Or there's limit. In the telephone system, there was very strong performance isolation. Mm-hmm. And actually, I've overstated it. It's not that there's no performance isolation. It's that actually the performance isolation is very weak mm-hmm. in statistically multiplex networks. And the whole issue of how you get suitable levels of performance isolation is basically the thing that has to be resolved in order to keep the scaling costs of the whole internet under control.
So performance isolation means limiting the interactions between users and between applications?
It probably means limiting it's the consequences, if not the interactions, mm-hmm. right? So, one of the things that we found is that another thing that people don't quite get in thinking about these statistical packet switch networks is that it relates to the issue of the opportunity cost of mm-hmm. carrying traffic. Okay, in a switched telephone network, there was a clear cost for that connection flowing along a particular path, because all the resources along that path were now associated and reserved for that data stream. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you could clearly see that, you know, there was a cost to that, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What we have found, even, you know, working with both regulators and with actually people who build the network, not build the networks so much on the engineers, but actually the people who
operate them,
form their policies and things like mm-hmm. that around them, is that the nature of the cost of carrying traffic has been lost. Okay.
Right.
so you know, there's a CTO of a rather large video on demand service who genuinely believes that putting more traffic over ISPs, they'll make more money. Okay. Whereas if you sit down with a bunch of ISPs when they're doing their planning exercises, you know, you see them say, well, we can't cope with this growth with our retail pricing policies and how we work. Everything's growing. We can't afford the costs, the opportunity cost of building the system bigger and bigger. But one sees no, one of the how can I say, the the relationship between how people view and have their analogies of the underlying statistically multiplex systems and the actual physical and mathematical reality of how it's worked have become disjointed. And that's a large cause of the pain.
It seems to me that a lot of the regulators and the advocates that are involved in the policy questions around the internet and the broadband networks that and wireless broadband networks that make up the user edge to it are still thinking about networks and circuit switch terms. I mean, when you hear claims like, well, I pay for X number of megabits per second, so I should always get X number of megabits per second. That's kind of a circuit switch way of thinking about things rather than a statistical multiplexed way, isn't it?
Yes, they see it as they see it as an entitlement because they've paid for some entitlement or for service, right? Whereas one way to look at it is what you've bought is an option.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is when you draw down on that option, right, like any futures, an option to be able to communicate in the future.
Mm-hmm.
If you draw down on that option, whether that option could be delivered to you at that time is a different question.
And certainly consumers are justified in believing that they're paying for something and they're entitled to get what they pay for.
Well, absolutely.
But it seems that we're a bit unclear about what it is that we're paying for. And so how do we know that we're getting what we paid for if what we paid for is not a circuit switch system with a certain fixed capacity?
Right. And I think that comes down to the key part of the question. What is it that statistically multiplexed packet networks deliver? What is the commodity that they are actually constructing and providing to people? And that's basically how we came about. We were working with people like telcos, like actually local governments who are building their own networks for their own uses, like in Kent. One of the things we've been looking at is what is it that you're subscribing to buying? What is the fungible quantity that you can talk about, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it is very clear that that is not bandwidth. Because a fungible quantity, like, you know, I don't know, gas for the car or water in a cup, right, is something that you can add and subtract and split up and do something with.
Right.
And, you know, there are things that you can't do. You know, 10 kilobits or 64 kilobits of bandwidth can deliver you a voice call or deliver you nothing, depending on the loss and delay characteristics.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty clear that the notion of bandwidth as the fungible quantity you're interested in is the wrong one.
So is this where delta Q comes into the picture?
This is where delta Q comes into the picture. So delta Q sounds a bit mathematical, and I'm afraid it is. But actually, I stumbled across it basically in looking on how to combine in reason. It was actually reasoning about ways you could do these stochastic process algebras with my PhD students at the time. How could you reason about issues of both continuous things like delay and things that are discrete like failures, okay, like packet loss? And you needed a language, or you needed a framework in which you could not just talk about the effects of, say, your queuing and scheduling algorithms, but also the effects of your transmission technologies, the distance you are from exchanges or between, you know, endpoints across the globe. How can you combine all of those factors together, including possibilities of getting struck by lightning, and so you have failure modes all in the same model, and end up with something that kept on popping out at each level as you did the abstractions at different levels. So you can start from the idea that, you know, I have a channel which has properties like it, you know, it has a particular delay and a particular failure to deliver, you know, uncorrectable error bit, residual error bit rate, okay, and combine that with processes and protocol implementations and say, well, you know, this is what it means in terms of whether my video on demand will have will pause during delivery to me. Okay.
So if we could think about it in perhaps less mathematical terms, would it be fair to say that delta Q is fundamentally a measurement of variations in quality?
It is, and that's hence the name delta Q. Yeah, but I think the thing it is it's about, it's a one way, it's a measure of how much disappointed you're going to be, right? I mean, it's one of those, one of the things that people don't get about networking is that quality is actually the wrong thing. You can't put quality into a network. You can't put silence into a room, mm-hmm. or darkness. It's mm-hmm. actually technically a privation. Mm-hmm. So what quality is the absence of something.
The right? absence of degradation.
It's the absence of degradation. So quality, delta Q is quality attenuation or quality degradation.
Well, and so it's in the nature of a statistical network that every packet essentially degrades the quality of the network for everyone else who's not interested in that packet.
Absolutely. And also it means that the best quality networks are ones that are not used.
Absolutely. Right?
Because they're empty at the time. So the first packet that flows across,
So this is the paradox of quality, that the network quality is at its maximum when the network is not being used.
Yes.
But we don't build networks to not be used.
and in that lies that very point lies a lot of the issues that people have with respect to networks, and statistically multiplexed objects. I mean, when, you know, 10, 15 years ago, the way you got the best ISP was to change ISPs to the new one in the UK, mm-hmm. right? Before they became overused.
Yeah. Yeah. When you're on the lightly used network, you're always going to get a better experience than you will with the network that all the cool kids are using.
Not always, but in general, that was a good bet. Okay. Mm-hmm. Right. Because it is a statistical game here. Right. Mm-hmm. So you can't always throw sixes all the time. So, right. So what you find this very issue has caused a lot of the, I think it's one of the reasons why people feel, peeved, I think is the right word, about networks, because they get onto them and they're the first user in their town or the mm-hmm. first user on there, and basically, everything works.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Right? And then what happens is the supplier of that network is actually over-providing. The quality that you are being delivered is actually unsustainable to mm-hmm. deliver at an economic cost point.
Well, at the moment of deployment, the network is designed to provide adequate capacity to all the users that the network operator anticipates signing up before the next upgrade. So you're sort of designing the network today to be functional a year from now when it has a lot more users. So it's never going to be better than it is on day one.
Yep. And basically, that if you're thinking of a sort of a fiscal model of this, there's a capital cost that you want to amortize over some period of time, and basically you need to be able to run that network without upgrading mm-hmm. for that period of time, for that set of users, for your user base mm-hmm. to pay back the money, right? And the problem that almost all of the telcos in the world have is that they can't do that.
You find this when you look at performance data over a longitudinal view of performance data, is that network performance on particular networks, it doesn't remain the same. It doesn't increase in a linear fashion. It over time is a sawtooth.
Yep.
So somebody implements an upgrade, performance goes up for everybody. And then it slowly degrades until the next upgrade, you know, comes along. And you see this pattern in all the data on network performance. You can even see it at the national level, where it will correspond to things like the rollout of DOCSIS 3 the rollout of 4G LTE. You can actually see the impacts of that in the performance data at a national level.
Yes, and it's actually relatively easy to model that. Okay, but mm-hmm. actually, the key thing this means, as was brought out in a PricewaterhouseCoopers report, I think about 2 or 3 years ago, was that this is causing a sustainability crisis for the world telecoms industry,
mm-hmm.
in that they are not being able to construct the returns on investment they need for the capital.
Mm-hmm.
So the general conclusion of that report was that they looked at over 70% of the world's telecoms, and they basically said they were borrowing money at 8% and returning a 6% return on it.
Yeah, I think that doesn't really work in the long term, does it?
And that lack of underlying effective sustainability is a problem for all of us. You know, I have a joke, which is I'd like to retire into the internet that I had in 93.
mm-hmm.
And that was 1993, right? Just in case this is being listened to mm-hmm. a thousand times, right? Because actually, they may still have the problems. You know, we may be at this issue of peak internet now, right? Mm-hmm. In the sense that the costs are anyway. It's this issue of how do you construct a. We haven't actually got a sustainable system at the moment. I think, and the expectations on that system are going up and up. So, for example, because the stories are good. The stories, the little analogies just give you an insight as to where people aren't thinking. Okay. So the UK last year started off a process of review for 15 to 20 years out, run by the Department of Culture, Media and Sport, on what would networking be like. Okay. And what was really interesting in this is if they went and approached other government departments. And basically, there was a theme that came out from all those government departments, which is they didn't know what it was, but they knew it would be there and they knew it would be free.
Hmm.
And it would be fit for their purposes and not cost them anything.
Hmm.
And that was being that assumption, you know, from the health people, even the military, for some of their activities, they were building that into their 15-year plans.
Wow.
They were building in this concept that what had happened is that the general, because I mean, I don't know what happens in the United States, but here I get bombarded with adverts, you know, have your broadband free for a year if you sign up to this package, right? Because in the DSL world here, the vast majority of the cost is actually in supplying the telephone line.
Right.
So if you take the telephone line, they'll give you broadband for £5, mm-hmm. right? Or
but that's enough. Because you're already paying you're paying the line charge to BT, right?
That's because the major cost in the wholesale network is keeping the physical copper alive, right?
Right.
Now that idea that it's free. That, you know, it's too cheap to meter. Has pervaded the society. You know, pervaded even the professional thoughts of some of these people.
Mm-hmm.
So if basically all of the providers in the UK can compete, because it's all about getting eyeballs and trying to get media. And I actually every time I look at the retail market, I think I don't know how it's just eating up capital somewhere, right? But the issue here is. That concept has pervaded other thinking. So actually, the idea that you should ever charge for networking has become a bit of difficulty here. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
In their long term.
They've certainly. So this is the impact of the unbundling regime on DSL, that the only dimension that ISPs can compete with each other. You've created a competitive market for ISPs, but the only dimension on which they can compete is price.
Yes.
And so that drives price to an unsustainably low level, because that's the only way to sign up eyeballs, and signing up eyeballs is the only hope that any of the ISPs have to achieve profitability in the future.
That last statement I don't think is actually true. I don't think they believe it will give them profitability.
Mm.
I think they're all trying to be the last one to fall off
oh,
the
okay.
off the fence.
So okay? Probably the long-term goal is consolidation will reduce the competitive pressures and enable these companies to be profitable.
I don't think even that's the case. I think the point is they don't know.
Oh.
Okay. I mean, they really don't. And I think that is the risk to the regulators, mm-hmm. right? And to the governments, is that the point is you have, you know, you get to the point where it becomes the lack of sustainability becomes unavoidable.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, we actually manage systems pretty well in the United States, or one system anyway, where the operational costs exceed the capital costs of keeping the system afloat. It's the federal government. So we just run a deficit. So is it inevitable that these economics, of course, this isn't, either one of us is training as the economics of network operations, but if it really is the case that these networks are unsustainable, that suggests to me that the only possible operator in the future is the government.
Which is probably not the best outcome, no. Right? Okay, for various, you know.
Yeah, it has implications for things like free speech and privacy and...
efficiency, right? But I mean, I think if I look at the value chain inside the United Kingdom, and we'll get on to the issues of the Ofcom report in a minute. But I mean, if you look, a lot of this is because of the models that they use to price this stuff are contrary to what the mathematics says underneath it.
Mm-hmm.
They're not even. I mean, none of the models are totally aligned. But some of them are basically going the opposite direction, right? So, you know, if you look at the models that are in the UK, because we have OpenReach, which basically looks after the physical stuff,
mm-hmm. Right?
That's to do with slight injustice. Wholesale that basically bundles that up and sells it onto ISPs, though other people become wholesalers by buying directly from OpenReach. The ISPs themselves then sell to the consumer. So, OpenReach is basically keeping the plant alive, okay, and keeping it powered and keeping it working. And that's basically a physical infrastructure running job.
Mm-hmm.
And the ISPs are trying to give it away as much as you want to eat for nothing, okay? So the only people that actually have a sustainable model is the wholesale system, where they do charge ISPs who use their services on the basis of the cross-sectional bandwidth at the point of handover to the ISP.
Mm-hmm.
And so as the load goes up, or as the peak load goes up at least, there is a revenue to pay for all the upgrades. Okay. Everybody else's models are not actually linked to the utilization of the system.
So the pricing for OpenReach to the ISP is quantity-based?
No. OpenReach doesn't sell directly to... In the UK, because of the way the model works, and let's just take a small ISP for the moment who isn't building their own infrastructure,
mm-hmm.
OpenReach doesn't sell to that ISP. It sells via wholesale.
Right, right.
And the point is that wholesale's prices, OpenReach's prices to wholesale are the same as OpenReach's prices to any other one person who wishes to perform that wholesale function.
And they're not quantity based. It's just a.
The OpenReach is actually port based, effectively.
Mm-hmm.
But wholesale's prices to onwards to ISPs or even handover points in Metro Pops, of which there are 20 in the UK, are all based on cross sectional capacity.
Well, that's the way the transit business works in the US, and I presume in the rest of the world. It's you pay for a 95th percentile on a particular quantity of data.
Yeah, but that means that at least given that per end user peak hour capacity requirements are growing somewhere like 5% per month.
Mm-hmm.
It's you know 5 ± 0.25 or something like that percent mm-hmm. per month. And that's a cost that somebody has to bear somewhere in the system.
So, and when you look at the system from one point of view, the pricing is all quantity based, or it's sort of bits per second.
Well, it's cross-sectional capacity based.
Yeah, capacity. So it's capacity pricing at one from one perspective, but from the consumer perspective, it's flat rate.
Yes.
And there's an inherent friction. I mean, the consumer flat rate pricing model is pretty much the only model that consumers will accept. But it's fundamentally different from the internal pricing models that are used by the various vendors of capacity.
Yep.
That keeps the system afloat.
The only thing I would take issue there is it's the only one they accept. It's they want everything for free, right? I think there are some ISPs that do actually do something different, and they do manage to maintain their quality better, and hence they have a slightly more sophisticated customers, right? There are people. That's not entirely true in the United Kingdom. For the big 4, 5, 6, it is true, right? Mm-hmm. They are perpetuating what could only be called a myth that they can deliver unlimited capacity to you as much as you want.
Well, and this discontinuity is not limited to the ISPs. I mean, companies like Netflix are playing the same game. I mean, they're selling content for a flat rate. It's like all you can watch. There's no, you don't have to pay extra for watching something for being a heavy user versus being a light user of the streaming service anyway. DVDs is a little bit different. But their costs, which are the content fees that they pay to the studios that produce the content, are highly dependent on, how much content they buy, what they decide to license, and what their terms of licensing are. And all those details are really buried under the end user price, which doesn't really fluctuate.
What I don't know about that process is, do they pay for each watch? Is there a fee? Do the studios extract more money for popular films or not?
I think in most instances, I believe the way that model works is they actually do pay a fee to the studios per view.
Right. So what you've then got is the same interesting skew that you have in the ISP community. So in this country, for example, you might have an ISP that's got several hundred thousand users, a white labeled ISP, right?
Mm-hmm.
Basically you'll have, going back a few years, you might have had the average utilization per end customer. If you took the total volume used a month divided by the total number of customers, might have been, say, 3, 5, 7 gig, right? Mm-hmm. Gigabytes. Then what you find is there are users that were using a terabyte.
Right.
But actually what you find is that there were also 20% of them that never turned it on or mm-hmm. something.
Mm-hmm.
So what you have is the people who don't use the system are paying for the people who do use the system.
Yeah.
Right. Which is a strange economic basis, because there is the risk that company's taking that the users that don't use it actually start using it.
Yeah, the only way that works over the long term is if the population of users who are heavy users in 1 month are not the same group of people who are heavy users in the following month and the month after that. So if we all sort of take turns at being a heavy user, so maybe 1 month I'm a heavy user because I'm downloading, Windows 10.
Mm-hmm.
But the month after that, I go back to being a light user. If it really alternated like that, it would be an equitable system, I think, in the long run. But I think the reality is it doesn't really work that way. I mean, there's a certain population of extremely heavy users who are just heavy users consistently.
And I think there's also another thing that's going on here, which is the light users become heavier over time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So basically, and in lots of ways, governments are looking for the light users to become heavier.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're looking for people to start educating themselves at home, using material off the net. They're looking to, you know, so you know, I hope my, you know, my mother is always my guide in this stuff. You know, if she suddenly gets interested in iPlayer, which is the BBC on demand service, her usage can go from what she's using at the moment to tens, hundreds of megabytes or gigabytes, right?
Well, and especially with new users and people who are historically light users, they're not comfortable with the system or they haven't found its value yet. But when they discover the value, boom, their utilization can just take off.
So you have, I've yet to find an ISP that actually quantifies that fiscal risk.
Mm-hmm. Well, they probably do it internally. It's not something it would be in their interest, you know, to publish.
Yep. I restate that. We have worked with many of them, and I have yet to find one that
does.
There was an answer in that question is what I'm trying to say.
By
experience, that is true.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. So it's interesting. That is true.
Well, this is a good place to pause the first part of the conversation, and we'll pick up the discussion about the Ofcom report in next week's podcast. So if you happen to come across this podcast on iTunes, you can read more and leave comments at the hightechforum.org website. And if you happen to come across it on the website, please feel free to subscribe on iTunes and give us a rating if the spirit moves you. So we're going to continue the conversation with Neil Davies next week.